Pour something flammable into your glass. It's Jaded Gamercast. My name is Lang. With me, as always, is Nathan. Now, we have a special treat for you guys. We pre-recorded an interview with Andrew Parks, one of the game designers for Star Trek Attack Wing, which we will be playing for you later in the show. But before we get that started, we figured we would do our normal shtick and bullshit and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah. Hi, Nathan.
Hello, Lang.
I know, right? It's awkward because I don't think we've ever recorded such a short, like, blurb, like the night I'm recording or like the day before the podcast goes live. So yeah, like as I'm moving everything downstairs, I'm just like, yeah, I still got lots of time tonight. Like I'm good. I don't have to edit this for like 3 hours.
Yeah, I know, because normally when we start recording at 9 on a Sunday for our Monday morning release podcast, you know, we're usually bullshitting until like 11:30, and then you're like, listen, I have to go. Like, fuck, right. I got to get this posted.
Like, I was like, I need to edit this, post it, and also sleep. And masturbate. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on.
Well, obviously.
So let's talk a little bit about what we did this week in hobby. Nathan, why don't you start us off?
Sure. I was able to get some painting done on my Dystopian Wars. I have 8 of my small ships painted, so 4 of my destroyers, 4 of my frigates, completely done. Mm-hmm. I also got my first game of Dystopian Wars in, where, wow, boy, did I get wrecked. Like, you know, you think you kind of have an understanding of how this game is going to work, because I'm like, I play Firestorm, I understand the movings and the shootings and the assaulting boats and... Oh my good lord, I got fucking beat like I stole something.
Mm.
But hey, you know what? It's the first time you're playing a game system. That is to be expected. So
typically, yes.
Yeah, so like I said, whatever.
So you didn't double crit a battleship? Roll double ones on a crit on like an untouched battleship in that game?
No.
See, that's what normally happens in games.
Yes, only when I play you does that normally happen. When I play other people for the first time, I get like fucked up.
And it's eating away at our whole relationship.
Touche. Because I was going to say, if I'm not mistaken, due to the powers of bullshit, you've never beat me in Firestorm.
Yes, and that's pretty much what it comes down to.
Purely the powers of bullshit. Like, yeah, I'm going to be honest here, and it's just like, this is not tactical acumen or anything on my part. This is just straight, unadulterated bullshit.
Well, you remember there was that, like, whole year where, like, I couldn't win a game of fantasy, right? Yeah. Where, like, that's just like that. It's the way it happens now. I don't understand why. For me, it was, you know, continuing to work on Firestorm, continuing to get models together and stuff like that. I had some plans to play some games, but those kind of fell through. So it was just a lot of hanging out, playing video games, cleaning models, magnetizing them, priming them, like just, you know, your general hobby excitement type stuff. So, you know.
So all the bullshit you hate doing before you can paint?
Yeah. Well, and I don't even really like painting anymore, so it's my hobby job. Like, that's all it is. You know what I mean? Like,
fair enough. See, at least I enjoy painting. Like, I'm having a ton of fun painting my Dystopian War stuff. So that's why I'm just like, yeah, this is great. And in fact, because like you said, we'll have 3 hours left, I'm like, I'll probably see if I can bang out 4 more destroyers before I have to go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Like, I'm just, it's fun.
Yeah. So, but did you enjoy the game at least?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. There are a lot of similarities to Firestorm Armada.
Right.
I do like the way that they do, like, one of the things that I horribly fucked myself with that, like, you know, it's just not an issue in Firestorm was apparently boats can't shoot through each other because you're not in space floating everywhere. So I like lined up this perfect thing where I swung like this, like I deployed my squadron in a box a la Firestorm so that I like did the movements and the turns and got my broadsides up and discovered that only 2 of the 4 ships were able to contribute. And I was like, well, this was valuable information that I should have had.
Well, did they earlier. Neglect that in the line of sight rules, or was this your typical skimming of the rule book read through?
Well, as I have said on numerous occasions, this is the most poorly written rule book.
Yes, I can imagine.
In any game I've ever played. So, like I said, just a couple things like that. Otherwise, the game itself was super fun. I'm actually loving the way that the Chinese Federation play, because they're a very off the beaten path kind of play style. Like they're fairly survivable. They have a high damage rating, very low crit rating. Almost all of my medium ships have a crit rating one higher. So I'm like 5-6. But they have a mar that makes you subtract one of your dice every time you're calculating your totals before you shoot at them. I also have the ability to string together some like generators that if you're shooting through treats everything as a small target.
Okay.
So yeah, so like I said, lots of really neat things. I'm not a long range shooting army. But then when I get into range band one, I just start throwing fire on you, and fire will, like, my flamethrowers are combined fire and really high attack dice. So my four destroyers, which are small ships, can throw 27 dice. And they land corrosive markers and light fires. So I'm just like, this is hilarious. It's just so fun to, like, full steam ahead and then, like, blitz fire everywhere. So I had a ton of fun. Even though, you know, at the end of turn two, it was like I'd lost two small ships, he'd lost two small ships, and then at the end of turn three, he had succeeded to get his old star order of 70% of my fleet was destroyed. And I was like, well, that escalated quickly. Holy shit, did things go horribly for me that turn.
There you go, man. All right, so let's move on to the weekly listener poll. The question that we asked you guys last week was, what do you think is the better option for a dwarf's army? Three dispel runes or an extra war machine of an equal points cost. This was a pretty close vote, but with four more votes, the fans decided it was the war machine. So, interestingly enough.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I think the big difference is the fact that 8th edition itself has shifted. Because when it was new, everyone was all about magic and anti-magic. You needed big magic. You needed big magic defense. And I feel like, you know, having played a ton of 8th edition, but like, you know, you the last few tournaments, yes, there are magic heavy armies. And you always know what they're going to be with Lizardmen and High Elves and things like that. But as a rule, like, armies aren't betting the farm on magic anymore. Like, Empire might take a level four, or they might just spam like three or four or five warrior priests, you know, things of that nature. And I think that might have been the deciding factor, because I know for me that's the biggest reason, because I'm just like, I just feel like three is excessive when you consider that I could have like a grudge thrower for that cost. And you know, like, that was why for me I'm like, one is a good buy for sure. No one's doubting that having a dispel scroll is not a great thing.
There you go. So Liam Wilson said, played a game with my dwarfs yesterday, took an all combat with no artillery list, taking two runesmiths with two runes of spellbreaking each. Interesting.
That's like 90 points.
What's that?
That's like 90 points of anti-magic. That's more than the three we just said.
There you go. Got lucky and both got the 4+, robbing my opponent of his two most valuable spells that were making his high elf shooting army work. Very worth it, especially since three of my main combat blocks had the Strolaz rune, allowing me to be in his face very early. I don't know if I've deciphered exactly which point he's making by the post, but yes, it's clear that he is leaning toward the runes.
Well, yeah, I mean, no artillery. Yeah.
Artillery is very much the case, right? Chris Carlston decided that he was going to come back with some White Scar stuff and then claims to have outflanked us. Brian Sin, Mr. Malorian, says, three dispel scrolls is just too much. I was thinking of taking two, but I'm even rethinking that. The tax of having to take multiple rune priests is just too much, and although armor piercing is nice, it isn't exactly game-changing. Those three rune priests with a scroll each would be three gyrocopters, and I will get work out of them in every game. So he's leaning the direction of gyrocopters.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know. I feel like armor piercing is going to be necessary for any dwarf combat unit not toting great weapons. And I think that's exactly it. And what I like about the rules is with Shield Wall and with the whatever one. My book's upstairs. I forgot to get it because I knew we weren't doing Dwarfs Part 2 today.
Right.
The one that's plus one strength the turn you charge. I feel like the game designers are kind of pushing you away from great weapons and into that hand weapon shield model that is so iconically dwarf.
Right.
And I feel like if you're going that approach to maximize both of those special rules, you're an idiot not to take armor piercing because at best you're strength five if you're long beards.
And again, they're relatively cheap characters, right? Before upgrades, before anything else that you decide that you want to do with them, they are still relatively cheap characters.
Oh, yeah. You just take one, give him a shield and a rune of stone. I think it's like 68 points. So even if you just don't give him a rune of spellbreaking or anything, he has a 2+, 5+ with shield wall. And that's pretty fucking great.
Right. Well, and again, he's getting the plus one from Relentless just the same as everybody else. So it's not like he's, you know, a slacker when it comes to combat, right? Like, I think there's more than enough that you can do with him.
And magic resist. And, like, you know, you're getting all of these sort of, like, trickle-down effects.
Everything kind of comes together.
And when it comes down to it, I think I would rather have two runesmiths than like a single organ gun. And we talked about how amazing organ guns are, but like, it's just the force multiplying effect of your combat blocks. With that being said, no, hammerers do not need a runesmith.
No.
Strength six, they're busting up pretty much anything.
Well, pretty much any great weapon unit isn't going to require a runesmith.
And that's exactly it. Strength five, strength six, you're getting the job done.
Right. It's when you're trucking around at strength three that you're depending on the charge and the armor piercing and all that kind of stuff to just really make them work the way that they're supposed to be working. I mean, I still hold toward the idea that the Dispel Scrolls does really help in terms of dealing with that magic phase. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, that's built solely on my... I ended up having a conversation with somebody this weekend that was, you know, come back saying like, magic doesn't do anything. It's blah, you know, dwarves don't need it. And I've been there, right? Like, it's...
Yeah.
It's one of those things where, you know, as I've said, I've never run into a dwarf army that has taken no magic defense that I haven't completely rolled over, right? They have the hardest time against armies that are non-magical because they've dropped so many points into, you know, dealing with magic and shutting down magic phases that, you know, armies that aren't dealing with, you know, really aren't dependent on magic in any way, shape, or form are just, again, crushing them, right? Like, it doesn't matter if you have two cannons and an organ gun on the table. It's not enough to deal with those armies.
As, you know, and I think that's, again, the brilliance of the Warhammer game system is you have to look at it and say, am I worried about magic or not? And that will shape what you're talking about, because I totally get it. Like, if you have no magic defense and you run into a super slan, you're going to have a bad day.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have a really fucking bad day. And, you know, but at the same time, like you said, if I'm betting the farm on magic defense where I've got like two, you know, like Liam said, I've got two runesmiths with the two runes of spellbreaking each. So I'm spending 90 points there. And then I've taken the banner rune of an additional plus two.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I'm really betting the farm. And then I run into, like I said, a low magic army like wood elves or something.
Yeah, I took a level two.
Yeah, you're like,
yeah,
I don't give a shit. You know, you're 200 points down on me.
Right. And that, again, like, that is the trade-off. Anyways, thanks to everyone who voted on our weekly listener poll. You can find those at jadedgamercast.com. We will have another question for you guys on the website, but not at the end of the show because, you know, when the show ends, it'll be a pre-recorded interview and we're too lazy to record anything else. So I'll just have a question for you guys up on the website there. Just act like we forgot. Like, just act like it's one of those.
Yes. I mean, you know, like I said, it's the typical caveat, you know, if we remember. And we're just telling you now we don't remember.
So we were very excited to see this, to have this interview, to get it on the show. And there is some very interesting stuff in here if you are playing Star Trek Attack Wing, specifically spoilers about the Borg. I won't say what it is, but stay tuned and you guys will enjoy it. Pour something flammable into your glass. It's Jaded Gamercast. My name is Lang. With me, as always, is Nathan. With us today, we will be interviewing Andrew. He is a game designer for WizKids, and specifically, he has worked on the Star Trek Attack Wing game, which Nathan and I love so very, very much. Andrew, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Lang. I appreciate it.
All right. So Why don't you just tell us a little bit about what you do with WizKids and Quixotic Games, and tell us a little bit about what your role with Star Trek Attack Wing was.
Well, I've been designing games for the past 10 years. We have 18 games that have been published that we've designed. Some of the games we design are games that we sort of come up with ourselves and we pitch to publishers, and other games that we work on are games that a publisher will approach us, particularly with a licensed game.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done a lot of games for WizKids and for NECA, and we were approached and asked to design Star Trek Attack Wing, and that was a little bit more than a year ago, actually, the adventure began. And one of my developers, Chris Guild, and I were the two main designers on Attack Wing,
mm-hmm.
and we just had a great time.
So when you guys were working on Attack Wing, obviously you've been approached by it, licensed material and so on and so forth. Obviously, the flight path system, quote unquote, comes from the Star Wars game. What kind of challenges did you guys run into when you were working with that kind of existing mechanic, and how did you really adjust it to make it feel more like Star Trek?
Well, one of the first things was a challenge that was identified by many of the people who were anticipating the game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, how does this feel like capital ships instead of snub fighters? And that was...
Thank you for calling them snub fighters. Good for you.
Yes.
No, I think I've done that 3 or 4 times, and people are like, the hell are you talking about? I'm like, snub fighters!
It's an endearing term. It's definitely an endearing term.
When my wife calls me, hey, asshole, it's endearing, right?
Yes.
I guess so.
So, it's a very different kind of a system, and therefore we had to have these ships that didn't turn so well. And, we use that to our advantage to create variety in the game so that, you have the Enterprise D, which can fire in any direction, but it turns like a tub. I mean, the thing has problems moving around, and it makes you feel that it's different than a Klingon ship, which, is able to make those wonderful come-about maneuvers mm-hmm. so much easily. That was one of the first challenges. The second challenge was we wanted the game to be a little bit more customizable. And therefore, that's why we opened up so many upgrade slots, because we needed it to feel like if you wanted to, you could really load these ships up with lots of crew or different tech and weapon upgrades so that you could really create a monster ship, a dreadnought type of a ship that, you would send out against, maybe a more agile fleet or someone else who had big ships. We wanted you to have that feeling that you've customized this ship and it's like nobody else's ship, even though, you're both using the actual same model.
Well, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. When you think about the Enterprise, regardless of which crew you're talking about, it's not necessarily the ship itself so much as the crew, because, I mean, we saw the Enterprise sister ship Miranda. That thing was a pile of garbage flown by scrubs, apparently. All they do is blow up.
Yeah.
I never, it's funny because not until
now,
you
are
say
we talking
it,
about the Reliant crew who were all stranded on Seti Alpha 5 by, 10 people in Wrath of Khan?
Well.
Because that's some scrub action right there. I mean, we've got a complement
Nathan,
of a couple
sure
hundred
was...
and 15 of Khan's followers are just able to single-handedly take over a ship.
I'm pretty sure it was Seti Alpha 6.
Nobody knows.
That's
nobody.
The setup.
This is Seti Alpha 5.
There you go. That was the setup. So one of the things that is very interesting about the game and some of the weird feedback that I get from people is that they feel like there's too many combos. Like almost that is the baseline of the game is the cards and the combos and things of that nature. How do you guys go about balancing those cards? Like, what's your overarching philosophy for game balance?
Well, the first thing is it's been extremely important to us from the very beginning to make sure that while having fun combinations is part of the strategy of the game, particularly when you're preparing for the match, that maneuverability is still the most important decision that you make in the game, that each turn choosing something on your maneuver dial is the single most important thing that you'll do on your turn, followed by which action that you choose to perform. That seems to me to be the essence of the system, and therefore that was very, very important to us. So when we were balancing
the cards, we would sit down, and at any moment that we felt like this card, it doesn't really matter how you play, all you have to do is activate it to win, that's when we knew that card needed some serious work. And one of the things that we've been encouraged by is that when someone does say, hey, I have a broken combination, the more experienced players will line up in single file to explain how they could destroy that combination.
Well, it's the internet. I mean, that's, you know, like Nathan and I are both list builders. So we spend more time emailing each other back and forth various attack wing lists. Okay, here's what I'm doing with my Cardassians this month. Here's what I'm doing with these guys. And we're both Dominion players, by the way.
Oh, I did try Gul Dukat on a Gore Portos at my
Gul
Dukats. with an energy dissipator last night at my Op 5 event, and it didn't work so good.
The energy dissipator is actually, it's interesting you bring that up. The energy dissipator used to be, I don't think I've ever revealed this before. This is kind of exclusive to your show.
Exclusive information.
It used to, almost until going to press, be range 1 to 2. I just figured I would mention
that. Oh my God. Oh, you son of a...
You know, because that was the funny thing is when I was using it yesterday, I ran into a Klingon player who just sensor echoed out of, like, every time I'm like, ah, this is it, got it lined up, then they, like, move one forward and sensor echo hard to the side. So I literally never got a shot off with it.
Well,
and then he likes it. Go for it, Andrew.
Yeah, I was just going to say the problem was when we were using it in playtesting, we were unusually unlucky with it, and so therefore,
I think most people are unlucky with the energy dissipator.
This can really hurt a playtest. Actually, is sometimes you will have a card that you think sucks because for some reason you just can't ever roll the average roll with it, and we have learned over the years to mark that down. But the energy dissipator is probably one of the more famous examples. And we were in a fairly late playtest. We weren't literally about to go to presses, but I would say that we were about ready to hand off the spreadsheet to WizKids. And we had a particular playtest where we brought new people in, and they said, what in the world are you guys smoking that this thing is range 1 to 2? It completely obliterates a ship, effectively, if you've set it up correctly. And so we really just focused on that card all night. And by the end of the night, we agreed somewhat. I was a little skeptical, but we changed it to range 1, and then we tested it with that another night, and then we were happy with it. But I know that some people, when it first released, some people were like, this card is insanely broken. And I was just kind of wiping my brow saying, thank God it was only range 1. But as you know, it can be absolutely devastating if you get it off.
Right,
but
yeah.
It would happen far too frequently, for sure, if it were range 1 to 2.
I don't know. Three attack dice versus a Romulan 6. I've never landed it on a Romulan ship, even setting up
with the Impulses. I think I got it up once on a cloaked ship.
Oh, well, yeah, I've hit a cloaked Klingon with it once, but like you said, it's a Fed killer, that's for sure. I love it. And I'm actually looking forward to using it as a Borg killer, because that zero evade...
Good point.
Yeah, that's going to be that's going to be one of the things that distinguishes some of these more powerful ships that you have coming out, particularly the Borg, is that they hit hard, but and they can take a lot, but they're not dodging out of the way.
Mm-hmm. All right. So as you've kind of said, they bring licensed material to you. Is this the first time that you've ever had to deal with hardcore list building super fan gamers on the internet when dealing with things like I'm doing finger quotes right now, feedback and the constant berating shouts of Romulans being broken. I obviously you're one of the
science.
Exactly.
I mean,
you post on BoardGameGeek.com, and so I know that you're active in the forums there, and that FAQ there is actually quite lengthy. But how do you tend to deal with that kind of response from fans?
Well, that kind of response is what makes us better designers. I know that there's a lot of passion out there, but to be honest with you. I mean, I have that same kind of passion with the things that I love.
You
I mean,
said
I
really... snub fighters. We already know exactly what kind of a...
fanboy, if I'm going to use the term snub fighters. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I get really passionate about things. I get really passionate about games that I play. And, you know, I may have gotten passionate on a game forum once or twice in my life. So I know where people are coming from. And I know that people are not... being passionate because they've got nothing else better to do. They're passionate because they care, and therefore that's the kind of feedback that we've had to learn as designers to really pay attention to, because the issue may be something larger than one card. It may be something where we learn about a completely different game. We might say, remember when that one thing happened with that other game? But, you know, getting back specifically to Star Trek, I would say that this is definitely the largest response that we've ever had to one of our games, as far as just the daily response from players. And it's very exciting, encouraging, sometimes terrifying. But, you know, it's very rewarding as a designer to see so many people talking about the game and building lists and talking about things that, you know, they wish had been different. You know, these kinds of things mean a lot to us, and we're very grateful for getting that kind of critique from the players.
Now, Nathan and I, as we said, we're both Dominion players, so we feel very jaded and angry because we're the stepchild of the Star Trek universe in terms of this particular game. But if you could kind of sum up the four races and what your plan for the playstyles of those races was in like a sentence or two, you know, what's the overarching theme of each particular race: Federation, Klingons, Romulans, and the Dominion?
Sure. I mean, let's start with the Dominion. I mean, hopefully, I mean, now, you know, now that you have your wonderful Gull Dukat ship,
Gull Ducats, baby,
and you've got the battleship coming out, you will feel less like the neglected child. But, you know, if you look at the Dominion, I think one of the things that defines them is that they have so many different diverse strategies, so many different surprises. They can come at the game from many different directions. And whether they are using energy dissipators to knock you down or coming in with the big attack on the battleship or firing, you know, driving at a wide arc or flying your ship at a wide
arc. Or just stacking EMPs on everything.
That's right. Or using your 180-degree arc so that you can bring your weapons in. I mean, there's a lot of different things they can do. And some of the other factions can do some of the things that they can do, but no one can do all of the things that the Dominion can do because they are a diverse faction. They come from different races. So therefore, we wanted them to feel, you know, if you're going to mix Jem'Hadar and Cardassians, what is that going to feel like? And what kind of combo can you come up with, even though they're all Dominion?
I just have one question before we move on. I think Dominion are the only fleet right now that have limitations on crew. Why did you decide that Jem'Hadar crew had to stay on Jem'Hadar ships as opposed to being able to freely go onto other Dominion ships such as the Cardassians or the Breen?
Well, a lot of the abilities, not all of them, not all of the Jem'Hadar are unable to go to other ships. But one of the reasons why some of the particularly powerful ones are is that they are employing technology which is in some ways almost game-breaking. I mean, particularly the ability to beam onto another ship through its shields or, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing. You know, we did not want that guy showing up on another ship saying, hey, guess what, guys? I know how to beam through shields. Because the reality is he knows how to do that, but it's part of the Jem'Hadar technology that allows them to do that. So that's cool. One of the reasons why they're particularly, if you notice, the ones that we're the most strict with are the ones that can do stuff through shields.
Right. And it's mostly thematic.
Right. Definitely for thematic purposes. And also for some degree of game balance in that, mm-hmm. you know, those crew ganking cards, which I think you're going to see more and more of as people come up with more interesting combinations with crew. You're going to see more of those crew ganking cards. And in general, we did want someone to be able to deflect those cards with shields until mm-hmm. they lost. So
I've been waiting for the fourth division battleship to take like all of those cards been talking about, like every one of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
yeah.
I got another question just to kind of add on to what Nathan had there with regards to the Dominion. Again, being players, we have these questions. It seems like when it comes to the Dominion, they tend to be the race that has the fewest options for modifying attack dice, whereas other races will have things like, you know, for the Klingons, you get your hands on Martok and Glory to You and Your House, Gowron. And things like that, right? And nuts. Romulans, yeah, exactly. Like Romulans, you make a green maneuver, and you've got Denotra and all these other things, and they all kind of just give you these across-the-board bonuses to attack.
Federation have a lot of crew options.
Federation have crew options that make it work. So, like, it really feels like that was kind of left out of the design of the Dominion. Was there a reasoning for that?
Well, not specifically for that, but the fact that we didn't want to give every single faction the same cards. I mean, the game, as we mentioned recently on Board Game Geek, is designed with cross-faction play. Mm-hmm. So if you want to play not with cross-faction, you know, that's totally fine. But if you're playing with cross-faction, you can go to other factions and find cards that do some of the things that you need them to do. We didn't want every faction to, over time, just look like each other with different, you know, makeup mm-hmm. on. We really wanted each faction. That's one of the reasons why, you know, the Klingons tend to have the very high primary weapon values. And some people were hoping that some of the Federation ships would have had higher primary weapon values than they had. And we, you know, we didn't want everything to just even out over time. Mm-hmm. So that's why some factions have things that other factions do not. Of course, bearing in mind that if you really, for the sake of creativity, want to include a card that does something like that, you can go to another faction and you pay the penalty of the 1 point.
See, but that just feels wasteful to me. So I'm not going to pay that 1 point.
that's part of the challenge.
Right, and that is my answer. All right, so talk a little bit about Federation.
Sure. Federation, I mean, for Federation, they have a different type of diversity, and that is they have a lot of ways to change the way they maneuver, and even though they don't necessarily have the most maneuverable ships, but they, in general, have really great firing arcs, and they have lots of ways to manipulate their dice, as you were just saying.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have the most firepower. They're certainly not the most agile ships in the world. So they're lacking on, you know, their primary stats, of the first two primary stats, I should say. But they do well in hull and shields, in firing arc, and in lots of different special powers that you can combo up with the crew members.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, not as much with tech, but with weapons and crew, and with elite talents. That's another big thing that the Federation has, is elite talents that allow them to do surprising things with their ships, whether it be engaged, or Corbomite maneuver, things that really kind of think outside the box, because from watching the shows and the movies, that's how the Federation has always been so successful, because they think outside the box at the right moment, and that helps pull them out of some real trouble.
All right. Wesley Crusher card in the future?
I can't spoil that for now. I don't know if that will definitely happen or not, but, you know, I would say it won't. So.
Okay.
All right.
Gamer too, so that would be fun, but I definitely
It just says Wesley Wines. That's all. It's just you can put it on for free, costs no points. Wesley Wines at the captain. Your captain's disabled for a turn. That's copyright me, by the way.
Yes, there you go.
You can't steal that sweet idea. Shoot. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the Romulans.
The Romulans, you know, they're about defense, as you know, and they're about being sneaky. They're about manipulation. They're about getting into positions where you can attack them. And when you can attack them, it's very hard to hit them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of our, so we wanted them to be more like a hit and run, and to be able to, you know, area control, like with mines and so on. You know, that was sort of the focus for them, is that, you know, they can hit hard when they need to, because they've got some big ships. But their primary focus is on agility and on tactical surprises.
Yeah, has anyone ever talked to you about the Romulan decision tree?
Oh god, yeah. We every time a new player in our gaming group picks up Romulans, we give them the flow chart of what action to do.
Okay. Are you cloaked? Yes, no. Yes, lock on. No, cloak.
Cloak. Bam. Romulans.
And that is your Romulan decision tree. Are you cloaked?
I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. Because I feel like, in particular, although they do have some great abilities when they're cloaked, we did actually include some cards, as you know. I think it's Nevek in the starter set who has an ability that requires you to have active shield. So we made sure that they had other options that would not involve...
Well, I'm looking forward to the new release with Romulan Commander, because then it's just like, action, shoot Picard in his stupid face.
Right.
Yeah. That's another example, you know, once again, did we want to give every single faction a 9 captain? I know a lot of people would like to have a 9 captain, but we said to ourselves, is this what, you know, once again, we don't want to make, I'm not saying that Romulans are never going to get a 9 captain, but I am saying that for now, we said this would be cool. This guy was a real competitor for Kirk. And what did we give him that would make him stand out as being different without just necessarily making him a higher captain? Skill, and that's where we came up with that ability. We were very excited. We tested it a lot, and you know, I think it's an ability that is going to surprise people. I think some people will think it's the end all be all, but it does take your action. Other people may underestimate it and say, well, you know, it's really just giving a captain skill of 10. But the reality is, you know, you're firing first against every non-Romulan commander in the game. That is going to be, I think, a serious strength that people will discover will help a lot of their strategies.
And interphase generators.
Yeah. The good old interphase generator. Once again, part of their sneakiness.
That's right.
Also, now, requires a tech slot. You're not putting it on a Valdor.
That's right, man. So let's talk about the Klingons.
Well, I think the Klingons were the easiest for us to know what we wanted to focus on. Of course, they couldn't just be about generating more attack dice, but I mean, a lot of what they do has to do with building up combinations for big attacks, whether it be with Barrage of Fire or Gowron. But of course, the other thing about the Klingons, which we found interesting, was that, you know, they have a different type of maneuverability. I mean, most of their ships all have the ability to do the come about maneuver. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the ability to get behind you and stay behind you and terrify you while they're behind you, I think, was a feeling that we wanted to have happen with the Klingons. And I think that works really well because they, of course, they also can sense or echo around. But typically, their abilities encourage them to do it so that they can get in close and stay in close, as opposed to staying clear of your firing arc, which is what the Romulans focus more on.
Gotcha. So with all of that in mind, obviously, we've got prize ships for the OP events. I've run some OP events in my local store, you know, with the kits that they've had come in, and basically go through everything. And everybody wants those friggin' prize ships, right? Because obviously, a lot of them, they're not models that have been released yet, and they're cards that you can't otherwise get. What's the design philosophy for prize ships? I think there's a couple so far that people really feel have been just amazing cards. Like, everybody wants them. Everybody wants multiples of them. You know, so kind of where do you guys go when you have to keep in mind that not everybody's going to have these cards available?
Well, I think one of the most important things about our design of the prize ships is that they do something unusual that other ships don't do, yet they are not essential for winning the game. Mm-hmm. So that's been one of the biggest things. And we've actually been encouraged by that whenever someone has come onto the forums and has said, hey, you know, it's like a new person who hasn't even played the game yet or maybe just picked up the starter set and says, am I going to actually be able to play this game without the prize ships? And by and large, the biggest tournament players come in and say, yes, you definitely can. You do not need the ships. They do. You know, there are some very, you know, interesting seminal cards like Barrage of Fire. But as you know, there are many ways around Barrage of Fire. Mm-hmm. So, and they've said it is not an essential card for victory, even for a Klingon fleet. So we wanted you to have your jaw drop sometimes, and that's exciting to us. But by the same token, we also wanted you to, once you played these in a competitive setting, to realize that they are balanced like the other cards in the game. So that's a tightrope that, you know, we've been walking from the very beginning. And I think that, by and large, people, feel that way, that they do not need to own those cards, but owning them is a real treat, and they do unusual things, that make them feel different from the cards that are in the rest of the game.
Gotcha. So Nathan and I together probably have roughly 1,000 points of Dominion.
Okay.
Conservatively.
Conservatively 1,000. Like, that's just ships, I'm guessing. If we start adding in cards, it goes a little higher than that. But for the most part, you know, this is because we're gamers, we're modelers. Like, I've painted my entire fleet. It's one of those things that, you know, we are so used to playing games on that level. After doing the OP events and playing the game at 100 points, which is kind of where, you know, after the starter set you tend to go, we start kind of looking into the range of, you know, 200 points or 300 points. Where do you feel that the game works best? Where was it designed for primarily? In terms of points value, points level.
Sure. I mean, the standard game that we play tested, and one of the reasons why we encouraged it for the OP tournaments, is 100 points.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, with 100 points, you have some really tough decisions to make. And while we have certainly played and enjoyed, you know, 200-point fleets or even 300-point fleets, it's exciting and there's a lot of ships, and it certainly takes a bit longer. The biggest difference with that many ships is the decisions that are needed to put together your fleet are a little bit less tight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine because you're having a good time. You just want to have a lot of ships out there. And you certainly have a lot of tactical decisions and maneuvering decisions to make during the game. With a 100-point fleet, or, you know, if someone's just learning to play the game, usually like a 40-point fleet, usually one ship with some upgrades. That's where we first started playtesting the game in the very beginning, was just 40 points. But when you're playing with two or three ships, or maybe even four ships, you know, 100 points seems to be a really nice spot. You know, 120 points also works pretty well. So, you know, that allows you to play with three or four ships and still have some variety of upgrades. So that also is a pretty nice number for the game and still makes you have to make some tough decisions when building your fleet.
All right, gotcha. Okay, so, you know, I think it's interesting when it comes to, you know, talking to players and talking about the OP events. There's scenarios that they like and there's scenarios that they're not necessarily super hot about. Like Nathan, for instance, before you got on this call, said to me, that OP scenario 5, I'm going to give Andrew hell for it.
Hold on.
And then I think he said something really, like, racial, stereotypical, but, like, I'm not going
to
repeat it.
You know, I try to. I mean, it's all in the character of the show. No. Before I go on to the tirade, I do have a question. Did you rate the scenarios for the OP events?
No. That's definitely something that my co-designer, Chris, he is definitely the OP guy.
The only reason I ask is I actually have a question because I feel like the store that was running the OP event was doing it incorrectly according to the instructions, but they were kind of vague. So an argument could be made in either way for either side. I'm just going to throw this out there if you know, and let me know if you know how it was supposed to go. In OP5, with the 6 orbital weapon platforms, are you able to destroy one in a single volley of shots if you get 2 or more hits? Or does it have to be 2 separate actions of ship 1 fires, takes the mission token, ship 2 fires, destroys it?
Right, it definitely takes 2 attacks. I mean, if you had a ship that could attack twice, then, you know, through a special ability, then you could take it out with that ship.
That's right. Klingon players discard once more into the breach to attack an orbital weapons platform.
Well, or
winning
you just
strategy.
Koronak.
Jory, Jesus.
You could take a Koronak.
Exactly. Or you know, there's even things you could do like forward weapons grid can hit a couple of them to kind of soften them up for your other ships.
Yeah, no, because like I said, it's the having to fire twice that I feel like 6 orbital weapons platforms is bananas. Because that is 24 attack dice being thrown out at every nearby ship, which is, like I said, bananas. Like, holy crap.
He's very bitter. He's lost a couple bad games from the orbital weapons platforms.
Yeah, yes. Month 2, orbital weapons platforms determined the outcome of 2 of my games. Month 5, 2 of my games also determined by orbital weapons platforms. So I'm just
at least
crazy.
You could take revenge against them in OP5, so that's nice. because you can shoot them.
I was going to say, it is better than OP2, where it was just like, no, you just eat it. You want to play merry-go-round with the planet to try to use your movement? I hope you like lasers hitting you.
So with that in mind and that feedback from Nathan, do you feel so far that this OP event has been a success, or do you feel like the reaction from players and fans has been the opposite of that?
No, I mean, look, it's been amazing, the reaction. I mean, the number of stores that are participating in various countries, just the way that people discuss with excitement and passion the OP events, and just as I said, the overall amount of people who are participating. One of the things you notice when you look at different session reports and battle reports are that, in the beginning, people were saying they had 4 people, and now people are saying they have 8 people and 12 people and 16 people. You know, so that it's showing that the game is growing. And one of the things that the entire Dominion War has allowed the game to do is to find like a focus for everyone playing the game, that they're building towards something. And I think that has really helped create a sense of community among the players as well. But for us, I mean, when we were designing the game, I had no idea that the game was going to be as successful as it has been. And so therefore, when we were working on some of the early tournaments, as I mentioned before, Chris Guild, he is the primary OP guy, although of course I look at everything and I play everything and, you know, give him feedback and everything.
So it's all you is what you're trying to say.
Definitely not. He's
taking the blame for OP5, that's is right. What I heard.
No, he is.
I have lost so many ships to orbital weapons platforms.
He's so it's ridiculous. He's so bitter. Let it go, Nathan. Let it go.
Have a dartboard with them to throw it on. But anyway, yeah, I mean, by every standard I can measure, I think that the entire organized play program through now has been exciting and successful, and we really just can't wait for people to start playing the next set, you know, going through the couple of episodes that we have with the Gorn and the Tholians, mm-hmm. and moving on to the Borg OP.
Wonderful. Let's talk about that Borg OP. What a segue.
Guys, so I set you up like that.
What can you tell us about the Borg? What can you tell us about the Borg OP?
Well, I can't tell you much about the Borg OP, because that will be it's still a little bit far away, and we don't want to give away too many surprises. I can at least tell you that many of the stories, similar to what you saw in the Dominion War, many of the chapters will be based upon events that have occurred in the movies and the television series. So that's something.
Can you confirm this, please? Please, does Wolf 359 be? Is that month one?
I can't confirm that for you right now. I'm sorry.
I will either confirm or deny.
I can give spoilers, but I can't give such specifics right now. Okay. I can give you a spoiler about the Borg in general.
Okay.
About which there has been very much conjecture, and this will be an exclusive scoop for your show.
Feed it to me. I'm ready.
I'm wearing my reporter hat as we speak.
My pants are off. Just go.
Oh, well, that's okay. Now maybe I shouldn't say anything else.
Okay. I take it back. I'm now putting my pants back on.
Okay, great. So the Borg, they move differently than any other faction. They have a very different way of moving. They only move in the 4 different directions that are on the X and Y axis. They do not move diagonally. They do not make banks or turns. They do what's called a spin maneuver. If they're going to turn to the side, that you actually spin the base and then move to that side. They can move forward or backward. So what it does is it creates a very different way of fighting against them, because you know sometimes where they're not going to be, but because they can move so well in all 4 directions, it's not like you can sneak up on them, and they have a 360-degree firing arc. Mm. So you're trying to make sure that you keep them in a right position for your weapons, but it makes the feeling when you're playing them so different that it creates a whole new nuanced way of approaching maneuvers in the game.
Mm. That does sound very, very interesting.
Any possibilities of a skin-grafted data card? And just call it, was it good for you?
It's an elite talent. Was it good
yes.
for you?
Yes. The board the elite talent. Can take it. I'm going to get on Photoshop as soon as this is done. I'm going to make that card and post it online for review. Oh, my God. So that's very interesting, actually. I'm trying to wrap my head around how to play them as well as how to play against them. I feel like so many of the tactics I'm used to playing with, especially with Dominion, because they turn like bricks, is basically that, like, you know, you kind of have to blow past your enemy fleet and then slowly swing around and just pray to God they make the wrong turn that brings them back into your forward arc. But with yeah. the Borg, you could never fly past them, because as soon as you fly past them, they're on your tail.
Right, but remember, because what's an interesting limitation is that because they don't move diagonally, you know there are certain times where you absolutely know they are not going to be, because they cannot physically move to that spot. And that has been what has made their ability to move both a blessing and a curse. And it makes, once you understand that, when you're playing against the Borg, it will begin to change the way you think of your movement and the way that you're trying to position yourself to bring your weapons to bear in the best way possible.
All right, so go.
Okay, I was going to say, have you thought about adding, you know, especially you talk about the Borg with how they move differently. There are some damage card results that are specific to, hey, if you turn, it's now a red maneuver. Have you put any thought into adding new damage cards to be shuffled into decks to specifically address certain new abilities that are introduced to the game as we get more expansions? Because, you know, we're seeing the Borg coming up. We know that there's going to be some Delta Quadrant stuff on the horizon.
Well, Nathan, presumably maybe spin their ships counts as turn. Does spin count as turn? Because then it would count on them.
Spin is something special you do before you move in that direction. So it's definitely not a turn.
But yeah, like I said, because as you're adding new things to the game that you hadn't even conceptualized when you were initially coming up with the initial four and doing all the playtests there, has there been any discussion as to the potential of adding in damage cards that would affect these things in the case of a critical hit?
You know, we haven't done that yet, but it is definitely something that we've talked about. We've talked about the idea that, hey, you know, it might be interesting to set up a situation where a particular ship comes with one or two damage cards. So not necessarily to do what you're saying, which is to put in stuff that affects that ship, but more to add in a card that says, hey, now that this ship is in the game, maybe I can add this particular damage card.
Yeah, I think that's what Nathan is getting at there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you're playing Borg or you've got Borg in your fleet, you add this to your deck of damage. You're like your pre-existing deck of damage cards. You go pull these cards out or something like that.
Right, it's not something we've implemented, but it's definitely something we've talked about. We've actually been talking about it in particular recently with the other game that we're working on.
Mwah.
That particular thing with the damage cards and adding new ones. Whenever we talk about the other game, it's totally fine.
So I've got two nerd skill testing questions for you.
Okay.
Is resistance futile or is it futile?
Well, it's not feudal because it's not the Middle Ages, so...
I was going to say, you are asking someone who is educated in the English language.
So it's futile.
I'm just saying, Data said it wrong. All right. Yeah, the other one, what is your favorite Star Trek alcoholic beverage from the shows or the movies?
Favorite Star Trek alcoholic beverage? Well, I'm not a heavy drinker, as you know, because I mentioned to you before the show started that I'm drinking diet root beer. So something like Romulan ale would definitely put me under the table way too quickly.
Ross couldn't handle his Romulan ale. So I'm watching DS9 because of the Dominion War campaign.
So I would probably have, you know, when I do drink, I end up drinking more sort of rarely, like maybe at a party or something like that, sort of people are relaxing or whatever. So I probably have some Altarian brandy. That would probably be my Star Trek drink of choice.
See, I'd have to go Andorian ale, because apparently it's like Jägermeister. So that would be the go-to for me. What about you, Nathan?
I am a fan of all things Cardassian, so for me, it's going to be Kanar.
Kanar. Nobody goes Bloodwine because we all have self-respect. All right. So can you talk a little bit about some of the other games that you are possibly designing?
Sure. You know, one of the games that I'm working on right now is the second expansion to Core Worlds, which is our deck building card game. So we're in the middle of that right now. So that we're hoping will come out later this year, 2014. And the other game that, you know, has been kind of making its way around the internet in the last week or so is Attack Wing Dungeons & Dragons, which I'm one of the co-designers on that game.
Fantastic.
And I am amped about Dragon Flight Pass. I am amped.
Yeah, it's,
like, I heard that and I was just like, why has no one thought of this before now? Like, I want to be playing with dragons right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the level of fun that we are having, we almost feel guilty getting paid to make this game because we have been Dungeons & Dragons fans. And I've been a Dungeons & Dragons fan since I was 7. I mean, so I know the license inside out, backwards and forwards, and having dragons and, you know, as has been revealed recently, that there will also be forces that are on the ground as well. So there's an interaction between different play levels.
Mm-hmm.
Of ground and air.
Will the dwarf models be smaller than the others?
Will the dwarf models? I'll leave that up to the model.
Are we going to talk about scale, Nathan? We really don't need to talk about scale, okay?
But it's you know, there's so much that's different and so much that's the same. I mean, you know, one of our big design parameters for this game is that if you play Star Trek Attack Wing, that you can sit down and learn this game in a minute. I mean, although we want to have different things going on, and there are a few different new rules for you to look at, but we want people to be able to sit down and play right away. But we don't want people to feel like this is, hey, you know what? This is Star Trek Attack Wing, and we're just calling it Dragons. I mean, there are so many things that are different in the game. I can't talk about any specifics right now, but I can tell you that the feeling, some people, I think, have questioned whether this is just going to be the same thing. And
so you're saying Dragons can't take photon torpedoes?
They definitely can't take photon
torpedoes. Sounds like a little bit bullshit to me. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Only fat dragons can have crew.
Yeah. Quantum torpedoes?
No,
you're losing me, Andrew. You're losing me right now.
But I mean, all I can say is, you know, people thought that the transition from the Star Wars to Star Trek was going to be just the same game with a different skin, and it wasn't. You know, and I'm one of the two designers on that game. I'm one of the two designers on this game, and I can promise you, this game has a lot of the same essential core mechanic as Star Trek Attack Wing, but the feeling of the game is so different in an awesome way that both games, I think, will have a place on your shelf if you can fit it on your shelf.
Will you call the intro scenario How to Train Your Dungeons & Dragons?
No.
Damn it.
I guarantee
you're not going to get sued? Okay.
That's definitely
fair
not.
Fair enough. Let me give you one of my wish list things here.
That's what we're going to call it.
That's what I'm going to call it, exactly.
You can call it what you will.
OP scenario one. you know, I would love to see a MechWarrior Flight Path game. You need to go feed that up the chain. I think that would be wonderful to see.
Yeah, I'm sure that would be kind of cool.
Really, see, for me, mine's more more Attack Wing related. I would love to see a Founder card that lets me replace a captain.
Oh,
have that one for free.
Well, nice. It should just be like
half not Picard. It's actually this command skill one scrub.
Exactly. That would be pretty rad. If only somebody could hear that and make it.
See, like I said, I'm not trademarking that.
Yeah. Okay. That's good to know.
Stop putting people on the spot, Nathan.
Making a mental note for sure.
All right. So in terms of, you know, Star Trek Attack Wing and, you know, kind of your involvement in it, what do you really feel like is your favorite race? Like, which one do you play personally?
I like to play the Federation, personally. But you know, usually when I'm playing the Federation, I will kind of have some guest stars from other factions on board. So I'm not very much of a purist as far as faction building. But if I'm teaching someone the game, say, I'll usually, you know, play Federation because I like that kind of the sophisticated tactical part of it that, you know, you're going to try to get in my face, but I'm going to have an answer for that. Mm-hmm. So I personally, and of course, you know, I'm a huge The Original Series fanatic. While I'm a big Star Trek fan of all of the shows, I've actually become a really, really giant Voyager fan. I had never spent much time with Voyager before working on this game, so I kind of Netflixed my way through Voyager,
mm-hmm.
and I'm now a very, very serious Voyager fan.
Interesting.
But because of my love of the original series, and that was, you know, that the original series Enterprise was one of the expansions which I personally designed,
mm-hmm.
with all the fun little characters, and you know, so I have sort of a special place in my heart for the Federation, and so that's why I usually prefer them, although I have no problem with recruiting a friend or two, you know, from another faction.
Well, as is thematic. I mean, how often does that happen in the show? I remember somebody was saying to me, like, oh, it's so dumb. You can't take old Scotty on the new Enterprise. I'm like, don't you remember the episode? He was on the new Enterprise, for
yeah,
God's
exactly.
sakes.
Yeah.
McCoy feel like an idiot.
The very first the pilot of The Next Generation, doesn't McCoy come on board?
I don't think McCoy ever shows up.
I thought in the pilot, as the old man McCoy, I thought DeForest Kelly
actually made an appearance
in the pilot. I'm just, it's been a while.
No, you're right. I don't think either of us are enough into TNG to be able to prove or disprove that. But yeah, there was absolutely the episode where Scotty was on the Enterprise and, you know, giving Geordi LaForge a hard time for being accurate in his, in his assessments of repair times. He's just like, no, you do it four times as long, and then when you do it in a quarter of the time, I mean, they call you a miracle worker, and you're like, this is the greatest writing in the world.
You call this scotch. Right? Y'all remember that episode. It's a good time.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've got time travel. You have the whole Generations movie. I mean, you know,
right,
you
exactly.
You have people meeting each other, going back in time, so why the hell not, you know?
Absolutely. All right, so, I don't know. What do you have, Nathan? You have anything else you want to ask?
Sorry, I just have to flip to that email thread where we had all of them. I had it open, and then I was like, it sounds like Lang is the one doing all of this.
It's all good. So when it comes to, you know, moving forward with the game, in terms of it expanding and the fleets getting bigger and the options becoming more and more prevalent, obviously you guys are going to be... Well, I guess my question is, when it came to like the Admiral's resource cards and kind of resources in general for the OP events, it seems like those are now a staple of the game. Like, it's not just going to be only use these in OP events. Like, people are using them in their private games and, you know, I think...
Flagships?
Yeah, I think everybody's planning on moving them forward. But specifically when it came to the Admiral's orders, I think that was the first time we really saw... you guys as the designers kind of reaching out to community and saying, you know, give us your feedback on this. And especially in our area, it was pretty clear that it was a really, really powerful combination. And it was just making games virtually unplayable. I know one of our frequent co-hosts here was running a two-ship Fed fleet. And I think he said he went 8 games with 0 losses, with 0 lost ships. Like, he didn't even lose a point in every single game with the cards as they were. And obviously when you guys came back after the feedback, it was decided that you could only take 1 Admiral card at a time. Do you guys feel like you're going to be doing that more often now going forward, really kind of drawing on the community?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we've been doing from the very beginning and what mm-hmm. certainly I have been doing as a designer. You know, I mentioned to you how it's helped our other games. And, you know, when I first started designing games, I was very resistant to feedback. I mean, even when I was designing them and when my first game came out, I was just, you know, people had some really strong criticism leveled at my first couple of games. And I've learned over time that there's really no way for me to grow as an artist without listening to what the players are saying.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I don't necessarily agree with a proposed solution to a problem, the people could be identifying a problem. And that's something that I need to think about either for that game or another game going forward. So I feel like being in touch with the community is such an important part of my own process as a designer. I'm a very collaborative designer. I'm not really a hermit who likes to sit and think on his own and then when I'm all done, show it to other people. Mm-hmm. So since that's how I design games with other people, once the game is released, I'm always very interested in what other people have to say. And I feel like, you know, people I think know by now from it's been, what, 6-7 months since the game released, that I'm there, I'm listening, I talk, you know, that what they have to say matters. And it doesn't mean I'm necessarily going to take everyone's advice on every issue, but at least they know they're being heard and that I didn't just say, well, I'm the designer, so therefore, you know, I know better. No, I mean, I really do, and so does Chris. We both listen to what people are saying, and we take it to heart, and we think about that as we move forward.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love the game. There's very little that I would actually – I mean, as much as we gripe about the Dominion and stuff like that, I really don't have a huge problem winning games with the Dominion or anything like that. And, you know, the Romulans aren't as bad as we make them out to be. I actually feel like it's a very well-designed game, and it's absolutely enjoyable. Nathan and I, we bought it before it was released. Like, I think we had just heard, we were all sitting in a room and somebody said like, oh yeah, they're making Star Trek version of that X-Wing game. And every single one of us were like, right, we're buying it. Who you playing? Okay, Dominion Klingon's done. And like, we'd already sorted out all the races and like we were ready to go. And then when the game launched, it was like clearing shelves. So, you know, I can't say enough positive things about Attack Wing. And, you know, I'm absolutely excited for the game going forward.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, you know, that sort of excitement of the imagination before the game released, and even as people are thinking about the ships coming up, I mean, as long as people are wasting time at work thinking about the game as opposed to, you know, kind of spacing out like an office space where he says he spaces out half the day. If we're making employers be less productive because their employees are thinking about Attack Wing when they should be working, we've done our job.
You've definitely done your job when it comes to Nathan.
See, you assume that, but I can bang a list together in like 10 minutes.
Oh, I know. You email every one of them to me. And before I can even like review your list, I have two more in my inbox. Like, okay, what about this one? No, this one.
Yeah. What if I swap this with this?
Exactly. All right. Well, Andrew, thank you very much for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you and get some insight on the game. A couple of sneak peeks, a couple of exclusives. I look forward to the Borg and the Borg OP campaign. Can you tell us a little bit about where people can find you on Board Game Geek or some of the other games that they can check out that you've designed?
Sure. Well, my name is just listed as Andrew Parks on Board Game Geek, so they can always just kind of put my name into the designer search and find me there and see the kinds of things I'm talking about. 99% of my time on Board Game Geek for the past 6 months has been with Star Trek Attack Wing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I do have, you know, some of the games that we've had that have been very successful have been, as I mentioned, Core Worlds by Stronghold Games. That has been probably our most critically acclaimed game that we've worked on. Mm-hmm. So that's one that people, and its expansion, Galactic Orders, has won awards from the Dice Tower. So so that's kind of exciting. And there are other games which that have not been mentioned yet. So I can't spoil them yet. But mm-hmm. There is another game that we did for WizKids, a board game, which will be coming out later this year. So that that hopefully will be announced sometime in the next few. Not on the scale of an Attack Wing. It's a self-contained board game, but we really had fun. We spent last summer working on it, and that should be, I think, coming out sometime this year, hopefully around summertime.
Oh, fantastic. Well, let us know when it comes out. We'll do a post on our Facebook page there and let everybody know to take a look at it. But thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That has been Jada Gamercast for this week. My name is Lang.
Hi, I'm Nathan.
And I'm Andrew.
Have a good one.
Cheers.